I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Stay-at-home orders have many juggling school, work, and home life in a confined space. The pandemic has also increased stress and anxiety, which makes living in the same space an even greater challenge. Later in the hour, we'll talk about the rise in domestic violence cases during the pandemic and resources available to those who can't safely stay at home because of abuse. But first, we discuss how to maintain peace while staying at home with your partner. Joining us is psychotherapist Kathy Smith Brown. Welcome.
Thank you, Mindy. I'm delighted to be here.
And psychotherapist Ken Friedman, welcome to you.
Thanks.
And we'd love to hear from listeners this morning. Are you enjoying the increased time together, or are you struggling to find time alone? Share your story with us, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So, Kathy, what are you seeing in your practice right now? Are you getting more inquiries?
I am getting a few. It's definitely down from what it ordinarily is when I'm in the office. Right now, I'm mostly seeing couples that I have already been working with on telehealth. Some of my couples have suspended therapy because they're doing well, actually, self-described success stories.
Oh. Yeah, Ken, what about you?
I'm experiencing the same thing. When I was seeing families and couples, the shift to telehealth was difficult for some of them to think about the logistics of managing five people, three people, two people on a device or something. But they have been sort of coming back little by little because quarantine has been very stressful for them.
Yeah. So what are some of the common themes that you're hearing from the couples you work with? Either one of them.
For me, it's... misperceptions and communication or intent, people who not feeling brave enough to be vulnerable and dipping into gender roles, having communication snags like that, imbalances of affection or connection, and, you know, people chronically testing each other, you know, is he doing the honey-do list? Is she, you know, welcoming home if I take a run to the supermarket, so on and so forth. And that spikes a lot of conflict.
Okay. Is that the same for you, Kathy?
Yeah, pretty much the same. You know, people struggling with either too loose schedule or too tight schedules, managing children's care and schooling, sharing. A lot of the people I'm working with right now are working from home and juggling sometimes too working from home schedules, as well as childcare and tasks and enough private time and enough time for themselves and for each other is significantly challenging.
Oh, yeah. And have you heard the opposite, too, though? Are there some couples who are finding that the pandemic and being together has brought them closer?
Yes.
I'd say yes. Yeah. Go ahead, Kathy.
I'm seeing people... tap into resilience that they didn't know they had, tap into humor that they had kind of lost touch with, develop a closeness. Even those couples, though, still have their challenges when it gets to be too much.
Yeah.
I agree. And similarly, people are trying to find a project to do with each other to improve the home environment, coming up with different parenting strategies to, you know, affect better family function. So they're sort of finding these external things that are popping into their lives urgently to bond over.
Mm. For couples who maybe were already a little bit unstable or considering a separation before this happened, this can really be a very difficult time. Mm. How do you counsel those couples? Ken, let's start with you.
So there's sort of a hierarchy, a decision tree of sorts that I follow, which is... above and beyond everything else, there has to be a reduced list of concerns that have to be communicated very clearly, like, you know, how much privacy of space and emotions are people requiring, and how much tolerance can the partner have for that. So figuring out, you know, if they're heading towards a separation or if there's tremendous conflict and they're not really working as a team, how do they get their space without being intruded upon? How do they not have to endure the regular rigmarole of couples flow that has been sort of breached in the recent past anyway? And then there's also coping of how to just deal with what isn't anymore while they're living together.
Yeah. Kathy, what about you?
Right. I agree with Ken. Every situation is different and every couple is unique. Sometimes I suggest, actually, this is for both possibly separating couples and couples who are going to try to use this time to improve their relationship. You know, we're talking about, you know, compassion, powerful listening, I statement, apologizing, appreciating, not criticizing. These are great strategies for couples, for all couples, in this time of enforced togetherness. Oh, and did I mention, no, breathing. Pause, refresh. If we all take a breath before we react, the world would be a more gentle place.
Yeah, I was going to...
You know, we can access our best selves. We come from a more mature place.
Yeah, breathing really is a solution to a lot of problems, isn't it? And you mentioned listening, and listening is one of the most important things we can do in any relationship. So it sounds so easy, but so why do we find it so hard to listen to one another?
I will field that because so there's two elements of listening that are really causes big struggles for people. One is what we tend to call mirroring, which is a basic way of reflecting back to the person what you've heard them say, whether you agree or disagree. It's just sort of confirming that you're receiving the thoughts that they're putting across. And people find it hard to do that without, you know, getting flooded with their own emotions or their debate points. Mm. And the second thing is figuring out intent. We're always scanning, especially when there's bubbling conflict in the background, we're always scanning to see about motivations of the other person. And we're looking like a radar to find, you know, blips that confirm that, oh, she's against me, he's against me, and it pops their radar. So that those are two main points to interfere with good listening. But mirroring is sort of a technique that has been used to sort of reflect back. It causes some discipline and clarity to be brought forth, and that helps a lot.
Yeah, that's a good point, because sometimes when you're saying, okay, I'm hearing you say this, and they're like, no, that's not what I meant at all, right? Yeah. Kathy, you have more thoughts on that?
Right. Well, you know, talking about why we don't listen, I think we don't listen because we so badly want to be heard ourselves, and our life histories are so full of not being heard, seen, or feeling important. But when we really, truly listen, it's like visiting the other person's world. And I agree with Ken. You know, mirroring is awkward. It's not used for just chit-chat, but in important conversations, you know, it's really important to reflect back what you're hearing so the other person can correct it or feel heard. I also think that we're always colored by our own histories and what stories we're making up while we hear our partners. So if we recognize that, we won't believe everything we think.
Yeah. You bring up a good point about not using it for every conversation. That would get annoying, wouldn't it?
Oh, definitely.
That's what I hear.
Definitely.
Yeah. One thing that many of us are stressing about is getting sick. And there's different information out there about how to prevent spread of the virus. We might not agree with our partners on what is risky behavior. Some therapists are recommending that in this instant, it might make sense to give in to the partner who's most worried. What are your thoughts about that? You know, let's say, for example, your partner is going to the grocery store every day and you're saying, no, that's risky, but you can't get them to stay home and you're worried that they're going to bring it home to you. How do you, you know, do you give in to the person that's most worried? What do you do?
Well, I think during these times, it may be wise to give in to the more conservative. But just generally in relationships, the more conservative person wields a lot of power. And so I ask couples, and, you know, this is an interesting time. I'm finding people have the time to try new things, and I ask couples to really think about what is my greatest need in this situation, so that they share with each other the greatest need they have for this situation. And when they hear that, I ask, is there any place you could be that you would agree on a decision that would satisfy both those needs? And if you particularly start with small situations, I find that people are very creative and sometimes easily can find that place.
I would agree. And also another point is that, you know, in this particular time when we're really talking about catching a very contagious disease that can yield death, it doesn't feel like it's fair to challenge an anxious partner to do it your way versus their preference of disinfection and safety. But as long as you have your own voice in the process, so comply with the more worried partner, especially under these circumstances, but also express, you know, if it was hard in some way, and just to do it as a communication point, not as an argument point.
Mm, yeah. Ken, what is empathy how does empathy play a role in a healthy relationship?
Well, it's very basic definitions. Empathy is the ability to sort of understand and identify with other people's feelings. It's different from sympathy, where you can just feel that, oh, this person's suffering and I feel bad that they're suffering. But you have some identification point about what resonates with you about the other person's experience. So that's my basic definition of empathy. And the question is how to manage empathy in conflict when we're having these difficult times. And people are if their own struggles are getting in the way of fielding the other person's concerns and then scanning understanding of their belief system, it gets very, very convoluted and conversations fall apart then.
Yeah. Kathy, do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah. And what I would add is that's a great time for couples to postpone their fight. Just, you know, go away, take 5 minutes. You know, I know one of the other things I'm concerned about is when one partner needs to go away, the other partner can feel abandoned. So before they are in the fight, when they're in a calm place, they need to agree that if one of them needs to go away for 5 minutes, they need to go away and say, I'll be back in 5 minutes or 10 minutes when I cool off. And the other one comforts themselves rather than chases for an immediate resolution.
Right. Oh, Kathy, especially in times of stress and anxiety, some people feel as though they need to fix a problem immediately. They rush to solve problems. And that can sometimes create more problems, especially if you're leaving your partner out of the decision making. So what are your thoughts on how to slow down in these moments of anxiety?
Well, again, breathing is fabulous. Duct tape works too. Oh, I'm kidding. But lots of times, one partner will rush to a solution when the other partner really only wants to be heard. So I think even ahead of time, in a calm moment, couples need to talk about, you know, when I present a problem, what is it that I want? And the other one can do the same thing. Sometimes I just want to vent. Sometimes I just want to talk about it, and I don't want a response. I think teaching couples to, one, be the speaker and, one, be the listener, so that they're not popping back and forth, interrupting each other, is a great skill. Not easy to do. Simple, but not easy.
Right. What are your thoughts, Ken?
Well, I'll add an element to that to back it up and say that one sort of shortcut I provide for couples is when you're feeling flooded in a conversation that kind of overloads you, the best response is to sort of go with an interview modality where you're positioning from curiosity and confusion. No one can get angry at you about either of those emotions, curiosity or confusion. And so you're not going to spark a debate necessarily if you ask your partner, so I'm confused, why are you bringing this up at this point? You know, and I'm also curious, do you want to fix right now, or am I just supposed to listen? And that just really enters in a much more clear communication platform.
You're listening to The Point. We're talking about how to maintain peace while staying at home with your partner and families. And with us is psychotherapist Kathy Smith Brown and psychotherapist Ken Friedman. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, we all have hot button issues. It could be as simple as leaving dirty dishes in the sink or as complex as feeling your feelings are being dismissed dismissed. And especially in these times, we can overreact when we perceive that these things are happening. Ken, what are your thoughts on how to recognize those instances when we may be overreacting and then calm down in those moments?
So I'm going to flip that around briefly and say that I heard a vignette from a master therapist, Terrence Real, who was doing a webcast during the pandemic, and he was trying to set up this webcast, and his wife had left the dining room table where he performs this messy, and he was ready to rage at her and decided to do a shift. And he said to her, "Hey, you know, honey, I'm pretty anxious about this webcast, and this mess is kind of freaking me out, and I have to set up pretty soon. Would you mind helping me clean it up?" And she was very compassionate to him, but he had to do a lot of work before he started his communication about that, to make sure that he was expressing what was going to be received well and what was also true. So I think that's how I wanted to address that problem.
Yeah. Kathy, thoughts?
Well, you know, one of the things that I'm suggesting to couples, and they're reporting that it's working well for them, is that, you know, in the morning, each of them take some time, 5 to 10 minutes, to get quiet, you know, to really come into their best selves, to see the big picture of our families in this difficult time, and to plan what they're going to do around these hot buttons, to take that pause. They're finding that, you know, they are more generous, more compassionate, a little bit more gentle, and a little bit more forgiving. So it starts with each person becoming their best selves. And a little bit of quiet time in the morning can help remind them of that through the day.
Yeah. One of the things
that, I agree with Ken.
Yeah. I say we're having a lot of pressures when you think about it. You know, a lot of us are working from home. So we're trying to get that done. We're, you know, living in these small spaces a lot of times with our children. And so we're trying to help them with whatever schoolwork or projects or things that they have going on. And I think for a lot of people, they're feeling like they're not achieving the task. They're putting a lot of, I guess, pressure on themselves to do more than is really possible to do. Right. So how, what is your advice to families who are feeling like, you know, I'm not being the best parent, I'm not being the best employee, it's really hard to get everything done that I feel like I should be doing?
You know, one of the things I would say is to take satisfaction in small things, but it's also important, as Ken was saying, when the fellow was talking to his wife about the table, we need to let our kids know, I'm having a hard time, or apologizing when, you know, I was a little impatient there. So recognizing that we're all struggling. The kids are struggling. The six-year-olds are struggling. The babies are struggling. There's too much togetherness. So that admitting that it's okay that we make mistakes during this time. We're all a little bit tense.
Ken?
I would agree. And, you know, sometimes enlisting your family as a sort of a Greek chorus or a support system where you announce to them, I'm on edge. You know, we're really not used to seeing each other, doing work, doing school, you know, commingling all these responsibilities in the same dwelling. And it's just very weird for me. And it's got to be weird for you guys. So that conversation can open up a family discussion or just the universal understanding about why anyone would be stressed out beyond a reasonable point at any point.
There have been stories in the news about divorced couples, sometimes even moving in together, even sometimes with their new spouses, to co-parent children. What are your thoughts on this? Is this crazy or can it work?
Both. It's crazy if you look at the optics. It's also individual by couple. But what tends to need to happen in situations like that, no matter how amicable or conflicted the divorced couple is, they have to just really understand what they're doing is they're activating a co-parenting role, and they have to set boundaries around what is expected from family systems in that dwelling and what is considered private space, both emotional and physical. And without those boundaries, everything can start falling apart. So it's possible to do it, but it is a hair-raising scheme.
Yeah, Kathy, what are your thoughts?
What I'd add is that you know, each person in that group, the adult group, has got to have done their own grieving process and be acceptable with what's in the present. You know, the best practices that we talked about before, taking a breath, you know, having compassion, good listening. It actually takes quite an evolved person or a group of people to carry that off. But I know a couple of families who are presently doing it, so I'm not going to say it can't be done.
Wow. Yeah, so we've all had the experience of getting so upset with someone that we lose control, shall we say, of our emotions. How do we prevent ourselves from getting to that point? And if we do get there and we're realizing we're kind of losing control, what do we do next? I know you talked about breathing, Kathy, but let's just say I've just gotten so upset and I'm saying, uh-oh, what have I done? What do I do next?
I think we apologize. It's very hard for couples to apologize. We're probably going to lose it. I think that if we have already started to lose it as quickly as we can, we need to walk away. It's not 0 degrees, although some days it feels it, but we can go outside. We can go outside for 5 minutes. As I said before, we need to make sure the other person understands we're not abandoning them, we're not leaving, we're just taking a break to calm ourselves down, because it is going to happen. I'm not seeing any couples at this point who are having trouble with violence, but people are yelling, and once you yell, you can't take the yell back, but you can say sorry.
Yeah. Ken?
I agree. And, in general, when couples are trying to reform trust and bonding, usually the only thing that can start working are tangible bits of history that's newly formed, where you have successful interactions or successful recoveries from arguments or such. And my focus then would also be on what happens after the conflict happens and how to revisit and re-explain and recontextualize what went wrong. And just being careful not to say, well, you know, you made me angry, but, you know, this is what you did that really, you know, stung me hard and made me decide that that's what you were doing. And, like, just to be clear about things like that. So people can reference those conversations more quickly when the conflicts are starting to brew. And the more history you have, the more ability you have to reference how this can work. And the hope then can come back in small little bits while the conflict is happening.
I'm also thinking, too, you know, for folks who have teenagers in the house, you know, teenagers are tough in the best of times. I can only imagine how tough it would be, having teenagers in the house. And, you know, I think those would be the moments where you'd kind of be really frustrated, both the teenagers and the parents, perhaps, as well. What are your thoughts on easing those situations? I know a lot of times teenagers spend a lot of time in their room. Maybe that's a good thing. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
I'll start and say that, this is going to be sort of rosy-colored glasses here for a second, but what seems to work well with teenagers is a contagious connection. So, like, for example, if the parents are sort of involving themselves in redoing the photo album or doing something connective, a project that's fun and bonding, the kids usually won't join in, but they'll hear it, and they'll get a sense that the tone of the home is better. And it lends to less explosivity or isolation in adolescence. But like I said, that's just the rosy color glasses approach. Mm-hmm. I'll let Kathy speak to the ugly part.
Well, I think we have to have greater patience with our teenagers. Lots of times, without realizing it, we're not very respectful, you know, of their thoughts. We dismiss them. Lots of times with teenagers, I will ask the teenager, sounds like you're paying your parents back. Are you paying your parents back? Is there some way you're feeling disrespected? And usually they are. They're paying their parents back, and their parents don't even know that certain behaviors feel disrespectful to the teen. So they're having those conversations. You know, what happens in this house where you feel disrespected, so that we really listen to our teenagers.
Yeah. Now, we have a grandson who's 5. So my husband and I both, when we get a little impatient, the other one will say tone so that we realize what our tone is sounding like. Maybe turn it around for a minute there. So what are if you are someone who needs alone time, this can be a challenge right now. So how do you carve out that time to help ensure both you and your partner get the space that you need?
I would say just literally schedule it. It's sort of counterintuitive, but everything in this time frame is counterintuitive of what we're living through. But, you know, we can't just rely on, you know, chunks of hours that we can decide if we can kind of break apart and, you know, take a drive or go into a different space of the home without people feeling offended or slighted. But to literally make announcements to people, hey, it's more than likely that between 9 and 11, I'm going to be inaccessible except by phone. And, you know, it's up to you whether you want to keep that or not. But if it's not scheduled and announced, people will tend to feel like it's obnoxious or distancing.
Mm-hmm. Kathy?
I agree. I think a relaxed but clear schedule of time for individuals getting a break. And people have very different needs. Some people don't need much alone time, and some people need a considerable amount of it, and that needs to be honored in a couple and in a family.
If a successful relationship could be boiled down to three things, or what would those behaviors or characteristics be? I'm sure listening would be one, right?
Yes. I'm gonna group a few things. First of all, fun, laughter, and good sex for couples. So that's all one at one. And again, the ability to talk clearly. One of the things that's important about good listening is the responsibility of the speaker is great as well. So I need to talk clearly with insight into my own issues and the part that I play. And then the third one is the ability to really listen without feeling defensive and recognize the part that I play if it's self-centered and to empathize.
So
I'd also sort of add to that, say, you know, what brought you guys together in the first place? Can you remember those things? Some people actually can, which is lovely. And to sort of re-spark a sense of a behavior that shows some yearning. And some people feel like it's an artificial maneuver and it's transparent. But at the same time, it sort of does something to the neurology of the deliverer and the receiver. If you show some sort of form of, you know, hey, what do you say we put some food together, go to a picnic in the backyard, and let's have a little date like we used to. And, you know, whether it happens or not, it's the request. So it's like, you know, the communication, seeking forms of yearning like that, and also having space to figure out how to clarify each other's irritability states and understand them better overall is the best three things I could put together.
All right. Psychotherapist Ken Friedman and psychotherapist Kathy Smith-Brown, thank you for joining us and sharing advice with us this morning. We really appreciate that.